And hello, everybody, and welcome to On the Line, our Lone Conservatives weekly newscast. I am your host this week, Robert Sasso. I'm filling in for Alex Sears, who's currently abroad in Israel. We're going to get right into it this week with two awesome guests and two amazing articles. First, first-time guest on the program, JL Sierra. How you doing, JL?
Great, thanks for having me.
And of course, regular panelist here and the founder of Lone Conservative, Cassie Dillon. Cassie, how you doing tonight?
Hello, I'm doing great.
Well, speaking of Israel, those were our two topics tonight. They're going to be two articles that are featured on Lone Conservative. The first one we're talking about tonight is Beyond the Wall. It was written by both JL and Cassie about their experience when they went to Ramallah. So to get started, I'm going to ask them a few questions. And the first one is, what struck you about Ramallah? What was the first thing that you guys noticed when you went to the city?
JL, you can go first.
Me. Okay. Well, for me, I have a pretty decent background in Arabic, in the language and the culture. So for me, just hearing all the Arabic around me was the first thing that got to me. The fact that I was able to understand what was going on really helped my experience, enhanced it overall. So that was definitely what stuck to me.
For me, I'm kind of like a worried person. So I Googled and researched a lot before I went there. So I kind of knew what to expect, but there were some things that caught me off guard. For instance, the border crossing. It wasn't what I thought it was. We basically just got off this bus right before the border and you walked through this weird hallway through one of those spinning doors, and then ta-da, you're in Ramallah or you're in the West Bank. Coming back into Israel is much different, but going in, I was like, what? That was a border? Okay. Going over the border in Cyprus up into the Turkish area was way different than this. So that was kind of weird. And then there's also just a bunch of guys hanging out outside the border who were very helpful and offered us directions and where the taxis were. So people were friendly right when I got over there.
That's really nice to hear, especially when you're in such a foreign area. You obviously don't know what you're going to say or do. Like you said, you had to Google kind of the area so you felt a little more familiar. And one thing I like from the article that I want to mention is your handler, or your tour guide, Muhammad, he said, under Trump, things have gotten worse for the people of Ramallah. He spreads racism everywhere and clearly hates Muslims and all Palestinians. I don't know if Clinton would have been better. It's a problem in the West overall. So going off that, did you find anyone's views in Ramallah surprising? Because that's a pretty strong quote that guy said.
Let's go back and talk about his name was Muhammad, right, JL?
Yes.
All right, so let's go back and talk about Muhammad real quick. So there's many stories about Muhammad, but I'll touch on the Trump story right now. So I'm a big Trump supporter. I've been very open about it, and all the people who were on the trip with me knew that. We were with about four other girls, and they knew that I was very pro-Trump. And he asked us, "Who did you vote for?" And there's no way I was saying I voted for Donald Trump while in the West Bank. That was not happening. I was not doing it.
The thing there was that he was talking exclusively to Cassie and I at the table about politics. It's weird how it kind of drew us there, but we were sitting there and he's talking to us. And before he goes on his rant, he prefaces with, "You guys didn't vote for Trump, right?" And so it's the first time I ever heard her refuse to say, "Yeah, I did, right?" And I played the Mexican card. I chickened out. Was there.
All right, so wait, hold on. So when I said it, I was like, of course I didn't. And all the other people in the room who knew me looked at me and they're like, and I like looked at them, I was like, don't you dare even say I did. I am in the West Bank. I don't feel safe here. Shut up.
Yeah.
That's the first time I've ever chickened out on college campuses. Heck yeah, I voted for Trump. I don't care about the SJWs. But when you're in the West Bank and you're in a place where you stand out, like we really stood out as Western women, white, or I mean, JL, you're not white, but like, yeah, I mean, you still stood out. You don't have your hair covered. You're clearly not a resident of Ramallah. So I was just in an unfamiliar area, and I didn't want to talk too much. I wanted to listen because I talk so much about politics. I really wanted to go there, just take a step back and listen. So I didn't want to go out right away and be like, yeah, I voted for Trump, and then get Muhammad over here lecturing me, even though he did anyways.
Well, I think also in the end, Cassie and I were asking him so many questions that it was kind of evident that we weren't totally on board with this Palestinian state thing he had going on. So we would ask a lot of questions, and sometimes he would be taken aback and go, "Really? You know, you're asking me things." And so his answers, I feel, they got increasingly blunt as we went on, you know, as to say, "I'm unabashedly Palestinian. I don't care." You know, to quote Linda Sarsour, "I don't care. You know, I'm unapologetically Muslim." That whole theme I felt really increased as time went on.
Yeah, and then another part of your question that you asked was, was I surprised by any views? And I was actually surprised by Muhammad in a few instances. Me and him bonded a little bit later on. I mean, I was walking with him because I really wanted to get his perspective. But when we asked him about the solution to the conflict, I thought we were going to get like some propaganda answer or something like, yeah, of course you want a two-state solution. Westerners, give us your money, you know? No, he was straight up. He was like, nope, there'll be no peace. Peace isn't coming. And I was like, wow, okay. Cut straight to the chase, Muhammad. Okay, good job.
So you talked about feeling a little dangerous with your political views. You obviously didn't want to say you were pro-Trump. Now, outside of politics, did you feel you were safe there when it comes to whether you were going to be attacked or whether you felt like you were not going to be accepted regardless of whether they knew your politics?
Well, I think that in general, when they see Westerners, they automatically think, oh, great, I can tell them the truth now, right? I mean, there was a part in the article where I mentioned that I was walking and yeah, like Cassie said, there were times where we could walk with Muhammad separately. And to some people, they would say, oh, wow, you're from the US. Here's what's really happening. Don't you see we're not all terrorists? That kind of thing. And so, of course, they go out of their way, right, to make you feel especially welcome and, you know, that kind of thing, which is great. And I'm glad. Obviously, I wouldn't want to be mistreated. But there's definitely, you know, territory that comes with being foreign. You know, that's their chance to prove to you what they want you to see. So there's that in the matter. But overall, yes, people were generally nice.
I hate to pull the woman card, but I'm going to do it. So being a woman over in the West Bank, I did not feel safe. We were traveling with a group, I think there was five or six of us that were women traveling together, just us. And when we were alone without Muhammad, we were looked at and talked to differently than when we were with Muhammad. That was definitely the case, especially on the way to the hostel. Now people were nice. People were generally nice, but people felt like they could talk to us a lot easier without a man being there. And obviously that's the case in some parts of America too. I'm not oblivious to that, but it's different there. People didn't know much English either. So when they're trying to talk to us, it was usually them trying to sell us something or hitting on us or something like that. But Jael and I did try going to the nightlife. We just wanted to go see what it was like after dark because Ramallah has this reputation in Israel for having really good parties and nightlife. So we decided we wanted to go somewhere. And I didn't feel safe going, with just me and her. The other girls didn't want to go. So we actually met these boys, these German boys in the hostel, and we went with them to this bar. And we talk about what happened at the bar in the article, which I'll let Jael explain. But I wouldn't have gone if they didn't come with us. I don't think it would have been safe. Now, I don't like going out in D.C. without men or without a lot of, like, a big group. But there, it was a lot different. And once she explains the bar, I'll explain what happened to me after the bar.
Yeah, so we were at the bar. That was interesting. Like Cassie said, we were with two other friends we had met at the hostel, and there was one that Muhammad had recommended, so we made our way over. He gave us a nice map, and we walked over, and we weren't quite sure where we were, given we just don't know the city very well. So we asked some local people, and they were headed there too. So we followed them over, and we tried sitting, was it outside, right? We tried sitting outside at first, because it was very crowded.
Yeah, we got some drinks and went outside.
Yeah, it was actually someone's birthday. I guess the owner's birthday or someone important. It was his birthday. We didn't realize. So it wasn't closed because they don't really close things off for personal events. He was like, oh, come one, come all. So we felt weird. So we went outside. And then the guy comes out and he explains, okay, guys, so here's the thing. There's a hunger strike, which means we don't eat, we don't drink, we don't have fun. We just don't do it. So you can do it. Just come inside where everyone else is doing it. You know, so in the earlier version of the article, I think I wrote, Palestinians stand in solidarity, at least on the outside. And that was kind of a pun there, but that's what, you know, struck me is that there's this cause that you're kind of obligated to be a part of, yet not everyone's going to adhere to it directly.
Yeah, that was definitely the case. And it was kind of just like hypocritical to me. I was like, okay, remember, I said I'm doing listening, not talking. So I was like, sure, let's go along with it. But I mean, you have to remember first, people don't drink generally in the West Bank. It's usually the young people who are secular, so, or even go to parties, you know. People get married really young there, and you don't do that. That's not part of the culture. So already being in a place like that, and then them throwing on the whole, oh, you need to come inside, even though we weren't really outside. We were in, like, a porch area. But then we went up with them, and then we ended up splitting up. And when I split up with them, I went with one of the boys because we wanted to go try another place, and Jael went back to the hostel. And when we were walking back, we walked through a market. And the market was shut down. It was really late at night. And going through the market, people were, like, hitting on me, even though I was with a Western man or just had a guy with me. and it was really creepy. I did not feel safe, and he was just a friendly guy, and he was talking to everyone, but I think JL, he knew two words. It was like Habibi. He just like, hello, Habibi, to all these random people at the market. Habibi means like baby. Like it's like a term of endearment. So that was funny. But the next day also, when I was walking with the entire group and I was with the boys in the back, this guy walked up to one of the boys I was with and asked him, he was like, oh, is she yours? Like that was actually what he said in English. He said, is she yours? And that just freaked me out. Like, first of all, like, that's none of your business. Second, I don't belong to anybody. Like, my feminism's coming out, like, going abroad, but wow. So that was surprising to me, honestly.
I mean, it's English, you know, there's a translation, is she yours, could have been just translation, because, yeah, you're right, a lot of people don't know English unless it's you come here, you buy this. That was a main thing, right? But, yeah, that's a thing. And also, the whole female thing happened when we were at the refugee camp, actually. It was like, as you said, it was the five or six of us girls along with the two guys there came on the tour. And there were a bunch of little boys sort of crowding around us and following us around. And at first they were just saying, you know, the English, hi, hello, what are your names? And then they began to speak to each other in Arabic, and it was not very becoming of them or of us, calling us females in other ways, in other languages. So, you know, there was definitely that eagerness to, you know, meet people and everything and be here and get to know us. But at the same time, you know, they do their own thing.
Jail. They didn't just stick in Arabic insulting us. They went into English and started throwing English insults at us after being all nice and we were talking to them. The second we turn the corner, all I hear is like, you female dog, you know, just shouting at me. I was like, what?
Where
you're the cutest little voice. How dare you? So,
yeah, but I mean, all in all, I mean, I admit, being in the West Bank for a few days, you know, that's a very small part, very small amount of time to be there. So we have our experiences, which are very real, very fresh. But at the same time, you know, Cassie, I don't know about you, but for myself, I was never in, you know, settlement areas or in any places like that. So I know what I experienced for sure, but there's still a lot to be left to experience and to see as a whole.
Of course, there's such a big disconnect the West Bank from being in Israel. It's much different going over there. So only going for a few days, you're not going to get the whole experience. You're not going to understand everything. So we're only talking about our experiences. I can't tell you how it is overall. I can only tell you what I saw. So that's what we're doing. I think some of the things I really want to talk about are some of the positive aspects of the West Bank that I really enjoyed. And that was people were so hospitable. Like everyone was like, oh, come to my house and have tea. And like in America, that's like kind of creepy. Like, I don't know you, don't invite me in your house. But like, that's part of the culture there. So it was really nice. We actually did go into this one house. It's kind of a tourist house. It's like one of the oldest houses in Ramallah or whatever. So we went in there and we had tea and we ate raw chickpeas and toured his house and he had art everywhere. And that guy had a cool story. He was actually a Christian. And he was talking about how he's just trying to preserve the history and the culture of Ramallah because everything's changing. He didn't want to get political either, which I thought that was really nice.
So one thing, Cassie, you talked about a lot was that you wanted to listen when you were there. And I think both of you, from hearing what you said, you both sounded like you took in a lot of knowledge and you took in a lot of your experiences. So to kind of wrap this all up on this article, what – Did you change your opinions at all about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when touring through Ramallah and being in Israel as a whole?
I did, for sure. There is one part that I changed my perspective on, and that was the refugee camp. Being in America and seeing how much money we give to the West Bank and to just the Palestinian Authority, we give a lot of money to them. People only hear about how much money we give to Israel. We give a lot of money to them, too. And I always thought, like, how can there be refugee camps? You're getting so much money. These can't be refugee camps. You guys have been there for 60, 70 years. There is a city there that's not a refugee camp. And no, after going there, that is a refugee camp. They lived in these type of, it was like skeleton buildings. Like, picture like the sitters or the squatters in New York City. That's what it was like. These people didn't have insulation in their houses. It was just a big concrete house. These kids had nowhere to play. It was just this complex where they would run around and get into trouble and call foreigners female dogs all day, but there was a serious problem there. And I don't think it's because of Israel. I think it's because the PA doesn't know how to distribute the money properly. And you heard that from the locals as well. These people don't leave the refugee camp because they get money there, money from living in there. So they'll stay there in these horrible conditions or have, I also heard that some of them have apartments elsewhere, but still get the money from being in the refugee camp. And another aspect of that you heard is they complain about everything, and they have the right to, but one of the things they complained about to me that was really weird was they complained about this building built next to the refugee camp that was it was a Red Cross or Red Crescent or whatever it was, and they were complaining about it because it put shade over the refugee camp and they didn't have the sun and it was too cold and they weren't hiring enough help. Like, they just kept going off about this, and I think that really highlights the fact that the money going over there is not being used wisely.
Yeah, that was definitely something they complained a lot about, was just, you know, where the money is going when it gets sent. I know we definitely did ask, you know, what about the UN and other international organizations? Don't they do anything to help, that sort of thing? And Mohammed said, yes, you know, they give money, but like Cassie said, it doesn't go to us. It goes into the hands of the PA and other groups that are involved who sign up for these grants and these funds, and they pocket all of it. So that's definitely an issue. I also found it interesting, though, and really unfortunate that it seemed like there was just no way out. You know, I mean, he talked about, yes, we need people to facilitate the transfer of the money, the movement from one place to another, but he was very stubborn and not wanting to let that get too far out of the, not the PA's hands, but of the people's hands, which makes sense, but it's really hard to facilitate that without, let's say, the U.S. coming in or the U.N., and he seemed very dissatisfied with the U.N. overall. But that was a big thing, and I don't think my opinion changed as much as it developed. I think I had a...
No way to put it.
Yeah, I think I had a healthy curiosity for the West Bank. I mean, I have a... I'm a little bit biased in the sense that I really do love the Arabic language and the Arab culture. I was with... How many? I lived with quite a few Arab roommates my entire year in Haifa, and I love them, and they're friends of mine. And so when I hear about this conflict, you know, this Israeli-Arab conflict, it's not distant to me. It's very real. And I think Cassie can agree, you know, by being there, you know, meeting people, it's no longer just a news piece. It's no longer just an item, you know, on the list going through. It's real, and people are real, and they have real needs. So I think it just really served to develop the situation overall.
Yeah, and I think for me also, I'm a very practical person where I really look at the facts and the things that are causing these situations rather than the feelings coming out of the situation. So the whole time I was there, I was like, what is the root of the issue? Why is this happening? That was the entire question I had in my head the entire time. And I asked everyone I met, what do you think is going on? Why is this happening? And it was mostly the same answer we got was everything was just being mismanaged. And you really saw that because we went from the refugee camp and then we went to the Yasser Arafat Museum. And yeah, and it was such a contrast. Like, it was insane. You go from this refugee camp where people are living in these little dingy little buildings that are not safe, they don't look healthy, they're freezing, they have blankets hanging up everywhere. And then you go to the Yasser Arafat Museum, which is one of the nicest museums I've ever seen. Like, it has this giant building and it's beautiful and all these different displays and technology, you have headsets. And then a couple blocks away, you have this refugee camp where people are living terribly. So that just shows that this money is going to places where it doesn't need to be going. Why build this giant museum to a guy who has borderline funded terrorism many times to having a refugee camp a couple blocks away where people are living in terrible conditions? It makes no sense to me.
Right. One thing I found actually interesting, though, about the museum, they had armed guards outside, you know, the beginning, which outside the front, excuse me, which, you know, is, I guess, to be expected. But to me, you know, didn't make that much sense to me. But I was a little bit taken by that. We walked in. And they had this, I don't know the exact word for it, but they had this setup where you had another armed guard in front of a big plaque. And Cassie, correct me if I'm wrong, was that supposed to be like a monument to Yasser Arafat himself? Is that what that was?
That because was his tomb or something.
Yeah, I think it was his tomb. And they had the Fatiha, if I'm not mistaken, which is the beginning of the Quran. They had that there in Arabic, and our friend Muhammad went up to it, he recited it, prayed, kissed it, and left. And he goes, anyone else is welcome as well. We kind of just, thanks.
Yeah, we all just kind of like walked out. I didn't even go in. I think I walked in and walked out. I was like, I don't want to be in here. I don't like things that this guy has done in his life. No, thank you.
Yeah, but I mean, even in the museum, they had, what was it, his quarters before he died during that whole, during a lot of the conflict, they had his quarters actually there in the museum, preserved very well. And it said, this is where he was during this time. This is where he would sleep. This is where he would eat. This is, you know, they had everything preserved very well. And it was very high tech also.
Yeah, and full of propaganda. They had something that was really controversial about 9/11. What was it? It was like, they had this display and it showed like towers or whatever. And then it was like, we openly condemned 9/11 and Palestinians had vigils everywhere. Like, there's actual videos of people throwing parties after 9/11 in the West Bank. So I don't know what that is. And then they also are talking about so-called terrorism. Like, I saw that somewhere. So
my favorite part of the displays for Hamas was when they tried claiming themselves as leaders of the feminist movement, you know, egalitarian suicide. They said in January of, you know, this year, we were the first to send a female to go suicide bombing.
Feminism for all. Let's all be suicide bombers. Like, what the heck? What is wrong with these people? But they think feminism is allowing women to blow themselves up.
Hey, I don't know. But that was hilarious, though, to see that they were proud of it. You know, we sent her off because she's a woman and her, too, can be a martyr. You know, that's where they were coming from. But I thought that was hilarious to read.
Yeah.
Well, I think one thing I could take away from this experience is that you guys definitely went in with an open mind. And like you said, you both developed your thoughts. And I think that's something that everyone should be able to take away with any endeavor, is that you should always go in with an open mind so you can learn. So one last time, that was Beyond the Wall, What Holds the West Bank Back. Both of these ladies wrote it. It's a very good article. Everyone should definitely go check it out. And transitioning to the next one, which is written by JL, Victims of the Temple Mount Attack, Who Are the Druze? And I think that has to be my first question to many people who are not familiar with Israel and basically all the cultures surrounding it. Who are the Druze and what impact do they have on the area?
Right. Well, I just want to preface this part by saying that, like I said, the West Bank, I was there in Israel for a year, and I spent my first semester focusing on the Druze communities, particularly the socio-political makeup of Israel, where the Druze are included. But that is such a complex topic as a whole. So, I mean, I did spend weeks, you know, in the villages interviewing rabbis and sheikhs, leaders of the Druze community, people in the village, tons of people. But in the end, you know, my ideas and everything, conclusions just are limited. But with that, the Druze are, as many articles have said, they are an official, not official, actually, they are an offshoot of Shiite Islam. They're actually an ethno-religious group, kind of like the Jewish. So they identify as Druze by ethnicity and by religion. So the religion was actually, what I find was interesting, it was open for a period of time. So people could enter in this religion. Egypt is where it began. They would convert to this religion. And then after a period of time, it was actually closed. It became a closed religion. So there's no conversion in or out of the Druze community. So now you have this group of people that are in Israel and have been actually in that land, in the territory, the northern region of the country, the Galilee areas, also in the Carmel, Mount Carmel, where Cassie and I went to school, that region. Your villages settled there in those places. And these villages are strategically placed outside of the main hub of the cities so they can maintain their ethnic and religious identity, because they do actually make an effort to keep many of their religious tenets a secret from the rest of the world. That's actually why, if you Google who are the Druze, there's a little bit more now, but in general, there's very, very little published on them. As a matter of fact, not much research, field research has been done at all on them, especially by non-Druze. That's very, very rare. Published-wise, I think it goes back to the Europeans when they were here during the British Mandate. That's about the extent you'll find research on them firsthand. But yeah, so the Druze community, they're ethnic and religious. Again, they are a sub-Arab group, so to speak. They do speak Arabic as their native language. So there's that. In Israel, though, what's interesting is that they're not treated like the rest of the Arabs, the Christian Arabs, the Muslim Arabs. The Muslims and the Christians are exempt from military service. The Druze, however, as of 1956, are not exempt. Their religious community signed an agreement with the government, and they serve a mandatory 3 years, or national service, as they call it.
Only the men?
Yes, only the men. They serve. The women have the option to do so. However, it's not required, and it's not in combat. A lot of them serve in hospitals. That's a common thing to find. That's the Jewish community in Israel. Unfortunately, I must say, despite their status politically, being so aligned with Israel and, you know, with the government and with the IDF often, there's still a lot of racism that occurs. Racism in the sense that you'll see Arabs, from both Arabs and Jews, you'll see Arabs looking at the Druze, Arabs meaning Christians and Muslims, looking at the Druze with kind of a disdain, right? Seeing them as traitors because they work with the Israeli government, or as some call them, the occupation or the apartheid force and whatnot. So they see them as traitors. On the other hand, you have Jewish people who still see them as the typical Arab terrorists or potential to be, right? So you have, they're stuck in this really difficult situation because a lot of them are very loyal to the Israeli government. I've had Israelis tell me that they're some of the best soldiers in the IDF. So there's that. So they serve very well. A lot of them are also, you know, proud Zionists. They are happy to be serving Israel. And a lot of them are not. Some of them say, I am Palestinian, and then I am Druze. And some of them say, I'm not Palestinian, I am Israeli, and then I am Druze. So it really depends. But there's definitely a lot that goes on within the Jewish community. And I think that's what makes it so unique, especially that this attack at the Temple Mount happened, and that it wasn't just Jew versus Arab, it was the Israeli government as a whole, an attack on the government from a Muslim Arab. So you have this situation, and now we're really seeing how the Druze being politically aligned with Israel takes a toll on the Arab community as a whole.
All right, I want to go off that a little bit. So I just want to let the viewers know that racism in Israel is a little bit different than racism in America. For instance, communities in Israel choose to segregate from different other people. So you'll have like Arab towns, Druze villages, which also they do have a lot of Arabs, Muslims in it too. So the racism is not exactly the same as is in America. You're not going to walk around as a Druze and like people aren't going to like discriminate against you like they did in like the 1950s in America. It's more just like you kind of stay with your friends, and that's just kind of what it's like, especially with the Druze. So the Druze are very highly respected in Israel because some of the best fighters are Druze. Druze are in the Knesset. I believe they have won a lot of cases in the Supreme Court too, so they're really high up there. I spent a lot of time with particularly one Druze person who is my really good friend, and his dad died while in the IDF. So his family has a record of, you know, joining the IDF, and he was proud to put on that uniform after what happened to his father when he was only 5 years old. So I think the Druze are a really fascinating community. Now, they have their own problems. There's some different parts of their community that I don't think is very progressive, but I do think that they're really good people, and their religion is fascinating, especially because they won't tell you about it. Like, you'd ask questions, they won't tell you. I know they believe in reincarnation. I've had a few conversations about that, but most Druze also don't know about their religion. I think it's like 1/5 of them are allowed to know about the religion or something, so they don't even know what their religion is. So I think the Druze are very interesting, and they're good people. And also, you can tell when someone's Druze or when they're Arab. Most Druze don't classify themselves as Arab. Some will, some won't, whatever. But you can tell when someone's Druze or if they're like a Muslim Arab or a Christian Arab. And that's usually because they have these really light eyes. Their eyes are usually like blue or like really light, like brown or green. So I don't know. I really think Druze are really nice people. And we had a ton of them at our school.
And you have friends that are Druze, right, Kathy?
I have one of my best friends is Druze. He's taught me Arabic. He's taught me Hebrew. I teach him English. He's my best friend.
One of the things you said too about the religion with the Druze, it's interesting. So with the Druze, when you're born, if you're born a biological female, right? If you're born a woman, you are automatically deemed as religious. So just like the Jews, you have religious Jews and you have secular Jews, J-E-W-S, you have secular and religious Druze. Yeah. So when the women are born, they're automatically considered on track to become religious Druze women, which you'll notice because they wear a head covering like the hijab, but it's white and it's not as constricting as the hijab. And then they'll wear black. The men, however, have to make the choice to become religious when they actually, I don't believe there's an exact age, I could be wrong, but they have to make the choice, and then they have to go through this screening process where they live the life of a religious Druze man, which is to refrain from smoking, from gambling, from profane, you know, things and thoughts. And then once they are deemed, you know, acceptable and worthy of being able to live their life long-term like this, then they're admitted into the religion. And that's when they get to know all of these secrets. When I was in one of the villages for a few days, I was with my friend and her uncle was a sheikh, which is a religious leader in the Jewish community. And he took me into their house of worship or prayer, which is different from a mosque. It's different from a Muslim mosque. It's called a hilwa, is I think the might be a noun offered to, but it's a different place. And it's interesting because you enter and they have a common area, you remove your shoes, and then they sit, you know, men and women, and they sit together in circles and they pray. And like Kathy said, their religion is absolutely fascinating. Although it did branch off of Shiite Islam, Muslims do not consider Druze Muslim, nor do the Druze consider themselves Muslim at all. Historically speaking, that can be debunked and debated, but as a whole, you'll never hear Jews say, I am Muslim. You'll never hear Muslims say, oh, they're one of us. That will not happen.
They believe in Muhammad. Don't get me wrong. They believe in Muhammad, but Muhammad isn't their spiritual leader. Their spiritual leader is actually Jethro, which is said to be the father-in-law of Moses. So yeah. That's very interesting because he died long before the Druze existed, but...
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think when we talk about religions and faiths believing in something, I think there's a difference between, and it's important to note the difference between acknowledging someone's existence. Like most people who aren't Christian will acknowledge Jesus' existence, right? Historically, some won't. But that, you know, usually it's accepted as a fact, historical, and Muhammad usually similar or the same. Their prophet by the name goes by Shuaib, which I've actually had very interesting debates, and I don't know if it's a language barrier or not, with one of my good friends. She's Druze, and she says, you know, Shuaib is Jesus, the equivalent. And I translated it, and I said, no, it's not. And then, you know, I was looking at interviewing her uncles and family members who are religious leaders, and I got, you know, Kathy said the prophet who is Moses' father-in-law, and I'm trying to connect the two. You know, it's really hard because they acknowledge Jesus as well. And they acknowledge, you know, my friend, she reads the Bible, she reads the Quran, she reads a lot of different things because all of these aspects are incorporated in the Jewish religion. Yeah. But so far, it's been really hard to understand, you know, what the main focus is. So that's, yeah, it's a mystery.
And I know we're running out of time, so I want to finish what I have to say on one more subject. And this is more an Israel-related thing as a whole. One of the most important things I learned while being there was that there is hope. People are starting to get along. People are starting to intermarriage. People are starting to live together. Living in Haifa, you see this population that's half Arab, half Jewish. You have Russians, you have Druze, you have Baha'i who live there for a little while and tend to the garden. So you're really seeing people coming together. But one thing I learned was that there's one place where they're already together and they're getting along and they're working together. And that's the hospitals. Because when they walk into the hospital, that barrier of your race and your religion is taken down. Your one goal is to save people's lives. So honestly, that's what the hope is right now in Israel. And if people start acting like doctors and nurses, I think there will be peace and people will prosper. And hopefully this conflict will come to an end eventually, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, to add a little bit of hope to that, what Kathy said, one of my roommates back in Haifa, she was Arab and she works as a, she's studying nursing, so she volunteers for hospitals. And she would come home and tell me how she has these amazing conversations with Holocaust survivors. You know, and she told me it really is a center, you know, for hope, the center of coexistence, because once I step in, you know, I'm there to help them and they're trusting me. And at that point, they don't care if I'm Arab or Jewish or Druze or whatever, you know, they're there because, you know, they need help and I'm there because I want to help these people. So Cassie, you're right on. That's very true. And I think it's a beautiful thing.
Well, like Cassie said, fortunately, we are running low on time. I think it was a great conversation today. I think JL and Cassie really did a nice job explaining to the viewers basically what's going on in the Middle East, and especially Israel, and basically what to make sense of. And just to, before I sign off, I'll recommend the article. It's Victims from the Temple Mount Attack, Who Are the Druze? JL wrote it. Everyone should go check that out after the program. So I'd like to end it with everyone just saying where they can find you. And Cassie, start us off.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Cassie Dillon. K-A-S-S-Y Dillon. And maybe we'll do this again when Alec comes back. He's usually on the show, and right now he's in Israel, which is really exciting, and I'm super jealous. But maybe we'll do this again when he comes back and talk about his experiences, because everybody has a different experience.
Definitely, yeah. You guys can find me on Twitter as well. That's real JL Sierra, J-A-E-L, not like a prison, Sierra, S-I-E-R-R-A. Thanks for having us.
Yes, and as always, I'm Robert Sasso. You can find me on Twitter at RealRobertSasso. I contribute for Lone Conservative, and I am the host of Campus Conservative. Everyone go check out those podcasts. And before we sign off, Alec would like a shout-out. Alec, we miss you. Hopefully you're enjoying your time in Israel. And thank you for everyone for joining on the line tonight.
Thank you.